President Donald Trump visited Iowa this week for a campaign-style rally in Cedar Rapids. He spoke in front of thousands of supporters, saying to expect big pieces of legislation on tax reform, infrastructure, and health care. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. This hour, I'll talk about the president's visit with Iowa Public Radio reporter Katarina Sestarik, discuss the importance of beehive weight retention with an Iowa State researcher, and I'll talk about the Iowa Supreme Court order banning firearms from Iowa courthouses. That's all coming up on this NewsBuzz edition of River to River, after this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. On Fridays, we like to host quick conversations on Iowa news of the week. In a few minutes, I'll talk with a Gazette reporter about an Iowa Supreme Court order banning firearms from Iowa courthouses. And later in the show, we'll learn about how the shift in ownership of a Des Moines apartment complex is bringing light to the lack of affordable housing in the area. But first, a conversation on the president's visit to Iowa this week. President Donald Trump was in Cedar Rapids this Wednesday to speak at Kirkwood Community College as part of what the White House is calling Technology Week. And later that evening, he addressed supporters at a campaign-style rally in Cedar Rapids. Iowa Public Radio's Eastern Iowa reporter Katarina Sestarik was at the event, and she joins me now. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Emily.
So give me an idea of how many people were there at the rally. What was the energy like?
So there were about 6,000 people at the rally, and they were all very excited to be there and excited to see Trump, and they think that he's been doing great as president so far.
Did they list any specific examples, things that they're glad to see are happening in the first year in office?
Some mentioned his nomination of Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court, and so he was confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. People were happy about that. But also a lot of them felt that he is being sort of held back by other sort of forces from living up to his full potential as president.
Now, were all of the attendees Iowans, or were people coming from all over?
There were people from all over. I talked to people from Mississippi, Minnesota, Illinois, Missouri, and then there were people from all over Iowa and some from right in Cedar Rapids.
So I heard reports of supporters and protesters lining up really early for this event. Did you get a sense of the aim of the protesters that were there?
They had a lot of different concerns. There were people there talking about the health care legislation. They were there for Planned Parenthood. They were there to support public education, and they had concerns about the environment.
Okay. Well, as you know, the Senate released their plan for health care for the U.S. yesterday. This was a day after the president's visit. Did he mention health care at all?
He did a bit. He was saying that, you know, with the thin there's 52 Republican senators, and so he was saying, you know, we can't lose anybody on this bill if we're going to pass it, and he was saying he hopes to have a great bill to surprise everyone with. And he also said that he wants a plan with heart, and he wanted to have more money added to the bill to support health care.
Okay. Well, one thing I thought was interesting that you reported was that, you know, the president being in Iowa, we're the highest producer of wind energy in the U.S., he poked a little fun at wind energy.
Yeah, he did.
We use electric, we use wind, we use solar, we use coal, we use natural gas. We will use nuclear if the right opportunity presents itself. We're going to be strong for the future. We're going to be strong for the future. I don't want to just hope the wind blows to light up your homes and your factory. As the birds fall to the ground.
So we hear a little bit of laughter there, a little applause. How do you think his comments on wind energy were met?
I think people were a little confused. Iowa gets more than a third of its electricity from wind energy. It has bipartisan support in the state, and basically, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have expressed confusion at this statement and say that they will continue to support wind energy and sort of fight any attempts to take it back.
Interesting. Well, and he mentioned ethanol as well. Iowa is also a huge producer of ethanol. What did he mention about that?
Really, all he said is that he said he is protecting the ethanol industries in Iowa, and he said that they are under siege. Not quite sure what he meant by that, but that is what he said.
You also reported that he said to expect big pieces of legislation on tax reform, infrastructure, and healthcare in the next few months. Did he get any more specific than that?
Not too specific. On taxes, he said he wants to pass the biggest tax cut in the history of the country. Infrastructure, he sort of mentioned. Airports, he thought that the airports in the U.S. were not doing so well, and that he mentioned, you know, roads and bridges crumbling. And so he just said that he wants to improve those things. And then, of course, on healthcare, he didn't really say any specifics, but he wants to have a bill passed soon.
The chairman of the Republican Party of Iowa, Jeff Kaufman, was there. What did he say?
So he first called out U.S. Senator Ben Sasse. He's from Nebraska, a Republican, called him out for criticizing Trump, told him to stay on his side of the Missouri River. It's a little bit awkward because Senator Sasse is supposed to headline a party event in Iowa within the next few weeks. And after that, he also called out the Cedar Rapids Gazette. So the Gazette basically wrote an editorial saying that now that Trump is president, they think that rather than having campaign events, he should be listening to concerns of people in the state. And so we can listen to what he said about the Gazette.
And the media. Anybody catch the open letter to Donald Trump on the front page of the Cedar Rapids Gazette? Come on, folks, that's Bush League. So here's the Republican Party's open letter to the Cedar Rapids Gazette editorial board. Donald Trump won this state. The citizens of Iowa gave him that victory. If you don't like it, tough.
A lot of emotion there. That was Jeff Kaufman, chairman of the Republican Party of Iowa.
Yes. He continued to talk just about the media, just criticizing media for using what he says are Democratic talking points.
The media. Yeah, we've talked with several reporters on the show before, specifically NPR's Sarah McCammon, who covered Trump during the election. And we talked to her about the treatment of reporters at Trump rallies. How was this experience like for you attending this event as a reporter, as a member of the media?
Well, talking to individual rally goers ahead of the event, everyone was super nice. You know, no one was like rude to me because I was a reporter. I had some very nice conversations with Trump supporters, and they did talk about the media, though, or the mainstream media as sort of like a mass. They said that they thought the media wasn't covering Trump's accomplishments, and that they were just focusing on what the media perceives as failures of the Trump administration and not showcasing what Trump is accomplishing. And so individually, person to person, people at the rally were not, you know, calling me out, at least as a reporter. But, you know, once Trump was getting the crowd really fired up about the fake news media, then, you know, everyone starts pointing and yelling.
Iowa Public Radio Eastern Iowa reporter Katarina Sestarek, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. This Tuesday, a 67-year-old Des Moines woman was sentenced to 16 months in federal prison for her role in a Nigerian email scam. You probably know the type of scam we're talking about. An email comes in from a stranger living in another country talking about their story of hardship and offering promises of financial gain. The Des Moines woman, Victoria Levin, has been sentenced to 3 counts of wire fraud. Here with me to talk about the case, the prevalence of these scams, and how to avoid getting roped into an internet scam is Jessica Whitney. She's the Director of Consumer Protection at the Iowa Attorney General's Office. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Well, you know, I have to say, this seems like kind of the oldest trick in the book, yet still at least 89 people sent money and became victims in this case. What happened here?
You know, people still fall for it. I know a lot of us think everyone knows about it, but people get caught up in the moment. People believe it can't happen to them, and they still fall for it. Now, in this case, this is a federal case, so we didn't work on it at all directly. But just in our experience, when you've got someone actually based in the U.S., which is a fairly rare occurrence, but when you've got someone based in the U.S., that actually kind of helps the scam along, because people feel like, well, I'm not actually wiring money to a foreign country. I'm wiring it to someone here in the U.S. And in this case, you know, I think it probably helped that the woman was in Iowa. We've got a reputation for being nice people, someone in the Midwest, and I'm wiring it to her, and therefore it's going to be okay.
So what are some of the red flags people should look out for in these cases?
I think whenever someone you've never met in person asks you for money, I think that's a huge red flag, especially when they ask you to do something like wire the money. Or another very common way these perpetrators are getting the money these days is through gift cards. They ask you to buy thousands of dollars in iTunes gift cards or thousands of dollars in Target, Walmart gift cards. And, you know, before you know it, that money is wiped off those gift cards. So huge red flag, you know, if you haven't met the person face-to-face and they're asking you for money, red flag number one. Red flag number two, they're asking you to wire money or send it via gift card or send cash. I mean, that's just another big warning sign.
Sure. So these con artists aren't generally asking you for your credit card, because that could be disputed or canceled, right?
Exactly. And that is the safest way to do internet transactions and transactions where you're not there in person, because you do have protections on your credit card and that money can get clawed back and you can get it canceled.
So how does law enforcement learn about a case like this?
People who've been scammed, I mean, once they realize that the check bounced and they're on the hook for the money that they've now wired, they'll come forward to law enforcement. A lot of times at a state level, we can't necessarily help them, especially if we don't have a local person. I mean, in this case you're talking about, there was someone local. But if they've wired the money out of the country, it's very hard for us at a state level to do it. So we'll refer them to federal folks, federal law enforcement, who can help them out. And that's how we find out about these things. The other really common way we find out about them is, quite honestly, our investigators and our attorneys in the office get the same emails, same calls, trying to perpetrate the scams. So we find out sort of both ways.
So these scams are pretty common then?
They are common. In fact, these scams, Nigerian check scams and other scams where it's someone pretending to be someone they're not, they're known as imposter scams. And recently they took the number one complaint spot with the Federal Trade Commission. They usurped identity theft. Identity theft went down to number two, and imposter scams moved up to number one, which tells you sort of how many people are falling for these scams all over the country.
And you mentioned that in this case, it was pretty easy to prosecute this woman because she was in Iowa in the U.S. Do we know what happens to these con artists abroad? Are they usually prosecuted as well?
It's different depending on where the perpetrators are located. Recently, the federal government did a big case in India with some of the tech scams that are going on, where people call pretending to be Microsoft or whatever and needing to fix your computer, and then your computer is held hostage, or they steal data from your computer. They were able to work together, I think, through a whistleblower, actually, that came from the company in India, contacted the federal government, and then the federal government was able to work with the Indian authorities to go after large numbers of people for that scam. I think that's more the exception than the rule. I think it's still hard to get a lot of these people because they're often in countries that we don't necessarily have good extradition relationships with, or we don't have the resources to find the people.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that, you know, if you get an email from someone you don't know, that's a red flag. But, you know, a New York Supreme Court justice recently fell for $1 million phishing attack. This was an email she thought was from her estate lawyer. Are you hearing about cases where people are fooled into thinking the message has come from a trusted source, a family member, coworker, friend?
Yes. It's sort of like an arms race with these fraudsters where the law enforcement gets a beat on them, and then they take it up a step. And now they've taken these phishing emails up a step, where sometimes they will, if they've hacked a certain email, they'll have access to that email account. They can actually send it from that legitimate email account, right? We used to always tell people to double check the email account, not just what it says, but actually the actual email account you're going to. In some of these cases, they've had access to an email account for 30, 40 minutes, and they're able to send out sort of always time-pressured emails saying, I need this right away, and you see the email's genuine, and you respond. So, yes, we've seen that. I think there's also technology that's gotten better at spoofing the email addresses. And what we always tell people is, again, look at the way they're using time pressure on you, that it has to be done right away. We tell people universally to stop, think, and call. If you think something's a little odd that someone might be asking you for money, even someone you know, in that sort of short of turnaround, pick up the phone and give them a call. Stop, think it through. The fraudsters know that they play on human emotion and human nature, and they want to get you in that time-sensitive moment where your heart starts racing and you think something has to be done right away, and they don't want you to think it through. So in situations like that where you get emails from someone you think you know and the email looks legitimate, but it seems a little odd that they'd be asking for that much money that needs to happen within the next hour or two, just pick up the phone and call them. That's your best advice. And also, again, if they're asking for emails in strange ways, wired, et cetera, that's another red flag.
Mm-hmm. All right. Jessica Whitney, she's the Director of Consumer Protection at the Iowa Attorney General's Office. Jessica, thanks for talking with us about Internet scams today.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this afternoon on River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. On Monday, Iowa Supreme Court Justice Mark Cady issued an order banning weapons in all Iowa courtrooms, court-controlled spaces, and public areas of the courthouses and other justice centers. Here with me now to talk about the order, how it fits into the rest of Iowa's gun law, and what happens next is Trish Mahaffey. She's a courts reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hi, Trish.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. So, what were the reasons Katie mentioned for why this order's needed?
He had mentioned, I mean, you know, it's kind of always been kind of a priority of his. He's brought it up many times. And they even did I don't know if you remember this, but I had kind of forgot about it. They did a survey back in 2015. They were trying to update the overall security of the courthouses. And anyway, they were mentioning because they had done a survey, and the survey came back, and people were like, actually, they had said that there were like numerous people that said they were actually scared working in the courthouses
because and so guns were coming in, or
well, just from like they were scared of like you know things that might happen you know in the workplace
okay.
because you know the courts are such a volatile place. And I mean, and I think this ban happened. I mean, I don't know. I tried to ask them if it was because of the new gun law. And of course they wouldn't say, but they just said, you know, it had always been their priority to security in the courthouses. And so I think they just thought this would kind of take care of, you know, the questions that have been out there. And, you know, lots of the board of supervisors that control the courthouses, they kind of took the heat off of them, you know, and what to do. And so I think that's kind of why it came about. But, I'm speculating, too. So,
mm-hmm. In your time covering the Iowa courts, have you ever heard of a case where a gun's been fired in a courthouse?
Not the there was that recent one, you know, in Jackson County in 2014 when it was Larry Coos. He's a former supervisor now, but he was a supervisor at the time. And they had some guy that came in the meeting and was mad at the assessor over like an abatement program. And he did fire his weapon, and then he ended up getting shot. He actually shot himself when they were wrestling. Coos like attacked or jumped on to wrestle him to the ground, and the guy shot himself, and he did die. And so, you know, that one, but that was in the courthouse, but it was like a county meeting that it happened in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I mean, there are, you know, families get, you know, upset during, you know, trials and everything. I mean, just recently in one in Linn County a couple of months ago, there were two, you know, the side of the family or side of the victim and then the side of the defendant, and they were kind of taunting each other back and forth, and it kind of like after it was on a break and they went out into the lobby area and they kind of broke out. It was like a physical fight, and the deputies had to come in and you know make some of them leave and stuff. And so you just kind of wonder, like, it's, you know, kind of gives me pause to think, you know, what if what if they had had, you know, guns? I don't know if they would have, you know, people would have used them or not, but it's just the thought that, you know, that stuff can happen.
Sure.
And there's, you know, emotions run high during court hearings and, you know, murder trials. So it's just, or any kind of trial, really. So, you know, I think that he basically, Justice Kennedy just wanted to kind of take care of that and just do like an overarching ban.
Mm-hmm. Now, we should mention there is an exclusion for law enforcement, right?
Right, law enforcement, and I think it's like county and city officials.
Okay. Do you know what authority Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Cady has to make this move?
He said that, according to the Constitution, that the Supreme Court has the power to exercise that supervisory and administrative control over the district courts.
So you mentioned before the bill signed into law this April. The bill signed by Governor Branstad includes a provision that allows Iowans to sue counties or cities that try to establish gun-free zones. It also allows concealed weapons to be carried into and around the Iowa Capitol by anyone with a gun permit. So how does this order fit into that bill, or is there a connection there?
Well, I mean, it does, but I mean, basically, that's what I think that, you know, the Supreme Court was doing, which is to say that, you know, that they have the right to make that decision about whether, you know, guns can come into the courthouses. And so I think they were just trying to answer that question. I mean, even the gun proponents that were for the new laws, you know, they even admitted when they were, you know, arguing back and forth, they even admitted that the new law wouldn't repeal any local ordinances that were already in place. And they did acknowledge the fact that, you know, the judges would have the authority, you know, to say whether guns were allowed or not, you know, in their courtrooms or in the courthouse.
So do you anticipate any challenge to this order?
I don't know. I mean, at this point, I don't know that there would be. I mean, if they want to take it up and try to argue about the, you know, the constitutional right of the Supreme Court to make this. But, I mean, they still, I guess, according to the new law, you know, people would still have a right if they were, you know, adversely affected, however you interpret that, by you know, not being allowed to bring it again. But, you know, at this point, I think there's still a lot of questions out there.
All right. And this is effective immediately?
Yes. It is effective immediately, the ban.
All right. Well, Trish Mahaffey, thank you for joining me today.
Sure, thank you.
Trish is a courts reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, talking to us about the Iowa Supreme Court's order banning firearms in all Iowa courtrooms. We're going to take a short break. Coming up in a few minutes on River to River, Joel Ashbrenner of the Des Moines Register will join me to talk about the pending sale of an affordable housing complex in Des Moines East Village and how the change in ownership could misplace many low-income immigrant and refugee families. Also, Iowa State University researchers are looking into how prairies could help our dwindling pollinator populations in Iowa. That's coming up in a few minutes after the break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
Thanks for joining us today on River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of the show with quick conversations on Iowa news to round out the week. Affordable housing in Des Moines is our next topic. Specifically, there's an apartment complex in Des Moines East Village that hundreds of low-income residents call home. Common to the buildings are immigrant and refugee families. The property is about to change owners, which could eliminate its subsidized housing, misplacing many of its residents. Here with me now to talk about the move is business reporter at the Des Moines Register, Joel Ashbrenner. Hi, Joel.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So tell me about the River Hills Apartments complex. Who lives there and how are they affording to live there now?
Sure. River Hills is a 1970s apartment complex, and like you said, in Des Moines East Village. It's home to a lot of refugee and immigrant families, including many who rely on federal subsidies, commonly known as Section 8 vouchers, to pay their rent. It's up for sale to BH Equities, a Des Moines-based company that just happens to be one of the 15 or 20 largest apartment owners in the country.
Mm-hmm. Now, what evidence do you have that the new owner will kind of change things up? Where does this idea come from?
Sure. So officials at BH Equities originally told me they do plan to stop accepting vouchers and eventually begin charging market rate rents. They've since said they're still evaluating their options, but ultimately their goal is to, charge a market-based rent rather than a subsidized one.
Mm. And I'm curious what a market-based rent would be, because, we're located here in Iowa City. You see a lot of new apartment buildings being built that are kind of, you could almost call luxury condos or, mm-hmm. That type of apartment. So what would be the market rate in Des Moines?
We've seen a lot of the same here. And BH Equities, it should be mentioned that they've said they want the apartments to remain affordable. These are relatively old apartments. They're not very big units, so they know they're not going to be able to charge really high rents there. They've mentioned some other apartment complexes that they said they'd probably be in line with those, and rents there are maybe $700 to $900 a month, certainly more than is being charged currently at River Hills. But BH Equity says they don't want to compete with all the thousands of new apartments being built in and around downtown Des Moines, many of which are charging $1,200, $1,400 for a one-bedroom unit. The folks at BH say, they think there's demand, a lot of unmet demand for a more affordable but still market-rate apartment. And to their credit, that's something that local leaders have talked about. Civic leaders say there's a so-called missing middle, a lack of kind of mid-level housing in Des Moines. And BH Equity says that's something they want to fill.
Mm-hmm. Now, you spoke with some residents. What did they have to say about this?
Yeah, I was able to talk to a few residents. There seems to be some confusion and some apprehension. Several people I talked to said they thought they'd be able to stay there with their vouchers. Others didn't really know much about the sale. I talked to one mother of three who said just generally it'd be really bad if residents were kicked out. She said, River Hills isn't the nicest place, but it does give people an affordable place where they can save their money in hopes of moving up to somewhere nicer.
Do they have any plans they do need to move?
The folks I talked to didn't have plans yet, and it should be said that they'll have, according to local housing officials who administer these federal funds, residents there won't get kicked out immediately in any case. Their leases should be good until June of next year, 2018. So there's still some time to see how this is going to play out. But, affordable housing advocates say it's not just about, finding a new place. There's more to it. These folks right now, they have access to a bus line and decent access to grocery stores. Even if they do find a place, they might lose the access to those necessities, or their children might have to go to different schools. So it just could be a big, very disruptive for the residents there.
Sure. And I can imagine, with a lot of immigrant and refugee families there, I can imagine they've maybe built up some type of community and support for each other.
Yeah, they certainly have, it seems. And I should say, we've talked to a few folks there, but have run into some language barriers and are still trying to find more people at River Hills to talk to and learn their stories and see what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. And is this change in ownership pretty final?
It's expected to, BH Equity says they hope to close the deal in August, but we have no reason to think that it's not going to happen. It seems to be on track.
And you mentioned that, the city of Des Moines is aware of this issue. There's a downtown boom, a severe shortage of low-income housing. Give us a little bit more of an idea about what the Des Moines rental market is like.
Sure. sure. We've seen, you know, like I said, thousands of apartment units in the works or open recently. A survey we did last year found more than 2,300 apartments were scheduled to open in 2017, give or take a few months. It would be a huge addition to downtown housing, but most of those units are at the high end, those apartments that are going for $1,200, $1,400 a month. For the longest time, officials in Des Moines said downtown needed more market-rate housing. Initially, the things people were building downtown were subsidized apartments, and it was difficult for renters above a certain income level to find places to rent. That pendulum has kind of swung the other direction, and now most everything that's being built downtown is high-end market-rate apartments, and if you're someone looking for an affordable place or a subsidized apartment, there just really aren't many to be found downtown.
All right. Well, we'll continue to keep an eye on this issue. And if you want to read more about Joel's reporting on the apartment complex in Des Moines East Village, you can check it out at the Des Moines Register. Joel Ashbrenner is a business reporter at the Des Moines Register. And Joel, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Each year in August, honeybee hives in Iowa begin to lose weight. And as they lose more weight, it becomes more likely that the hives won't survive the winter. While researchers at Iowa State University are looking into ways to safeguard beehives and their honey supply, and they recently received a three-year, $1 million grant from the Department of Agriculture's National Institute of Food and Agriculture. This grant is set to look into how prairies may help honeybees keep the weight on their hives. With me now to talk about this project is Matt O'Neill. He's an associate professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Hi, Matt.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Thanks for joining me today.
So, thank you for the invitation.
When we talk about hive weight loss, what specifically is happening?
Yeah, so the honeybee hive has a bunch of things inside of it. It's where all the workers are raised and where all the food is stored. And one of the biggest sources of food for honeybees is the honey that they convert from the nectar that they forage from flowers. So these honeybee hives, when they lose weight, they are consuming the honey that they're storing for the winter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when did we first begin to realize that these hives were losing weight? I mean, I can't imagine all the hives in Iowa are on, I mean, I don't know, are they weighed regularly? Is that how we figured this out?
Yeah, it was because we were taking more kind of fine-tuned measurements that we became aware of the timing of this weight loss. So beekeepers typically leave their hives someplace that has a lot of forage for them. And at the time, the experiment we were doing, we were putting hives in places where they would be foraging on soybeans. We wanted to learn about the relationship between honeybees and soybeans, both in terms of the yield benefit that might occur to soybeans, but also the benefits that bees might receive by foraging on the many flowers that soybeans produce. So what we found in trying to measure that health benefit to the bees was that pretty much over the course of 2 years to the week, we saw a start of a weight loss that began in the first week of August and continued throughout the late summer into the fall. And this is really worrisome because it's during that time that bees should be gaining weight so that they would have enough honey to last them through the winter. And anecdotally, we've heard from beekeepers in Iowa and around the Midwest that often they have to feed their honeybees in the fall just to get them to survive through the fall and into the winter. So that's really, really worrisome because throughout the Midwest, we've had reports of up to 30 to 40% overwintering loss of honeybee hives. And part of the loss is attributed to a lack of food.
Okay.
Well, I was just going to say, so I think what our data suggests is that there's a lack of forage for bees from August through to the fall. And what's remarkable in Iowa and other parts of the Midwest is that there are native plants that typically flower during that time. And these are plants that would have been found in tall grass prairies.
Okay. And, you know, I didn't know this. I read it when I was looking up what you were going to be researching with these honeybees. Honeybees are actually not native to North America. So I guess when Iowa had lots of prairie grasses and flowering plants, did we have a lot of honeybees?
Yeah, not so much. Honeybees are not native to North America. They were brought over with European settlers, and they've been kind of moved across the country as European settlers took over most of the continent. And what we found is that from the beekeeping side of things, clover is a really attractive forage for bees. And many of the beekeepers attribute a lot of the honey that there's produced from clover. And when we've talked to beekeepers, they'll say, yeah, wildflowers are kind of nice, but they don't see it as a real source of forage for their bees. And that's not too surprising, since less than 1% of the original prairie that was found in Iowa exists today. So one of the novel things that we're trying to do is see just how valuable that prairie can be to beekeepers and to native bees as well.
So paint me a picture of what you're going to be doing with this grant, because Iowa has a lot of soybean fields. We have some areas that we're designating as prairie areas. So how are you going to be conducting this research?
Yeah, so there's three sort of large objectives. One is to see within soybean fields how much of an impact pesticide, specifically insecticide use, has on honeybee health. And so we've put honeybee hives in three different types of soybean fields: ones where we're not using any insecticide, ones where we're using insecticide whether it's needed or not, and then a third type where we're employing integrated pest management. We're using insecticides only when it's needed. And across those, we're going to track the health of the honeybees. And then a subset of all those bees in August are going to be moved to prairies to see if we can recreate this rescue effect that our graduate student Ashley St. Clair observed in the preliminary data that went into the grant. And on top of that, we want to see if there is an effective pesticide exposure, if that rescue effect by the prairie also helps the bees overcome whatever pesticide problems they may have. And then the last objective is to look at how honeybees interact with native bees. A lot of people who are putting land back into prairie are interested in conservation, especially, you know, for the native flora and fauna. And there's concern that if you brought honeybees to prairies, there might be a negative interaction with those native bees. So our third objective is to get at just how much of an impact honeybees can have on those native bees. And if we can mitigate some of that impact, lessen it by just exposing the bees, the honeybees, to prairie in the fall when they most need that forage to overwinter. And I should say that this is a team effort. I'm just one small part of it. We have two honest-to-goodness honeybiologists, Drs. Amy Toth and Adam Dolezal, who are leading up a lot of the bee work. And then Dr. Aaron Hodgson, who's our field crop extension entomologist, is helping do the extension part of this, get the information out to soybean farmers, to beekeepers, and to people who are interested in conservation, so that we can all kind of get on the same page and figure out what's going to work best, not only for our honeybees, but for our native bees as well.
Honeybiologist, that is quite a title.
Don't Google that. That's kind of shorthand for the colleagues I work with that do a lot with honeybees, a lot more than I do.
Well, and briefly, Matt, we want to mention there is a pollinator festival at Ryman Gardens tomorrow. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so every time this year is the National Pollinator Awareness, and at Iowa State University, Drs. Toth, Dolezal, Hodgson, and others celebrate it by having a festival at Ryman Gardens. It's from 10 to 2. It's free, open to the public. We have a very generous anonymous donor who supported the festival and other outreach activities with regard to honeybee health. And so from 10 to 2 at Ryman Gardens in Ames, there'll be a bunch of activities to learn about all the great things that honeybees do, the different types of other bees that are out in our landscape, and there'll be a honey tasting, so you can taste the different types of honeys that are produced when bees have access to different flowers.
Matt O'Neill, Associate Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. Matt, thanks so much for joining me today to talk about your research.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yesterday, Governor Kim Reynolds and Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg announced Des Moines as the state's 66th Home Base Iowa community. Home Base Iowa is a program designed to help veterans as they transition from military to civilian life. And here with me now to talk about the program and what it means for Des Moines to be a home base, home-based community is Jason Kemp. He's the program manager for Homebase Iowa. Hi, Jason.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I hope you're doing well as well. So tell me more specifically the aim of Homebase Iowa. As an Iowa veteran, you know, how do you engage with the program?
You bet. So the program was originally designed or envisioned to highlight all the opportunities that Iowa presents for veterans. And kind of as the program moved forward and has grown over the last 3 years, what we wanted to do is grow it from simply a marketing campaign to more of a liaison. So we travel to over 40 career fairs outside the state of Iowa and also attend career fairs inside the state of Iowa. And the intent is to educate and attract veterans to the state in order to fill the jobs that that many of our employers across the state are looking for.
Mm-hmm. And what types of jobs are employers looking for?
So Homebase Iowa, we have over 1,600 businesses statewide, and they range from part-time work to PhD-level positions across all industries, from construction to medical to IT to engineering and beyond.
Yeah. And does this kind of fit with the types of jobs that Iowa veterans are looking for?
It does. We've had a lot of success so far. The website continues to grow, and as we continue to market and spend time talking to folks and educating them about the program, we find that we have more and more success. I think that there are a lot of veterans looking for that job once they transition out of the military, and even after they transition out of the military, maybe looking to make that next step. And Homebase Iowa provides a platform to promote and create awareness for opportunities that we have here across the state.
Mm-hmm. Now, I see that Homebase Iowa, one of the goals is to make incentives for veterans to settle here. When you talk with veterans, what are some of the incentives Iowa's bringing, and are there any drawbacks, things that Iowa could be doing better to attract veterans to the state?
I think some of the great veteran incentives are the fact that we have a very low unemployment rate here. You look at the unemployment rate, it's 3.1%, and you add to that kind of Iowa has an aging workforce. About a quarter of the workforce is over the age of 55. So certainly there are opportunities here now, and I think that you can make the argument or the case that there's going to be a lot of opportunities in the future as well. And I think that's one of the selling points is military veterans transition out of the service. They're looking for an opportunity. They're also looking for a great place to raise their family, safe communities, great schools. And Iowa is certainly known for both of those things, which also make a good case. Additionally, back in 2014, the governor and the legislature overwhelmingly passed the Homebase Iowa Act, which included some very good incentives, which the state doesn't tax military retirement pay. They offer in-state tuition to automatic in-state tuition to eligible veterans and their family members, along with veteran preference in hiring for both public and private companies here within the state.
Senator Grassley has recently come out saying that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs intentionally withheld Iowa veteran wait times. That's what he said. And we've heard from Iowa veterans who don't go to the VA because they see it kind of as more of a hassle than a help. So I'm curious, what is Homebase Iowa doing to reach veterans that are feeling disenfranchised with the system?
One of the great things about the program is, again, we can connect the dots between organizations and kind of act as a sounding board and help veterans with those kinds of issues. We connect with the Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs, the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs, local county veteran directors, and other agencies across the state to kind of help solve those problems as they arise.
Now, Des Moines being the state capital and largest metro area in the state, it kind of surprised me that it's the 66th community in Iowa to become a home-based community. So, you know, how do cities obtain this status?
Great question. And so when it was first conceived, the home-based Iowa community concept, there's four criteria. And the first one is either a city or a county can become a home-based Iowa community. The first step is to pass a a resolution in support of it, either by the city council or the county board. The next is to come up with an incentive package that's specific for veterans and transitioning veterans who into the community. The next is 10% of eligible hiring businesses must become Homebase Iowa businesses. And then the final one is the sign placement, if as many or as few as the community chooses to place. So I think that over the last, I know Des Moines, been working with Des Moines for over a year now, and I think that the businesses, the business count was probably the largest sticking point. And seeing how we recently upgraded the website, all our Homebase Iowa businesses are listed online and they're searchable by city or by county, which makes it much, much easier for communities to become Homebase Iowa communities.
Jason Kemp, thanks for talking with me about Homebase Iowa.
You bet. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Des Moines recently became Iowa's 66th Homebase Iowa community. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese and Chelsea Hoy. You can contact us anytime to talk about what you heard on the show or give us show ideas. You can reach us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Have a great weekend.